This is the Art of Darkness podcast with Kevin Kautzman
and Brad Kelly. We're a couple of very online writers interested in the dark side of what drives creative people to create against all odds.
This show is about art and the people who make it, what it costs them, and what it takes to bring something unique and impactful into the world.
Each episode, we excavate the life and work of an artist you might think you know.
Don't worry, they're all safely dead.
On every episode, we try and find out just what the hell was wrong with them and how they worked through their darkness to create something that lives on after them and continues to move culture.
Find us online at artofdarkpod.com and on Twitter at Kevin Kautzman and at Brad Kelly. All right, and we're back again with another episode of the greatest podcast by two writers dissecting the dark side of artists and creatives on the internet. What's the name of that podcast, Brad?
Art of Darkness.
That is it. That is it. And you are tuned in, and I'm really excited. We just did the Tennessee Williams episode, and that means it's your turn, Brad, to take us down the primrose path.
That's right. It's a fast turnaround, man. And that's cool. That's good. I'm ready to go, man. I've got the incense burning. I was shuffling some tarot cards. I smudged the room and all of that. Right. So I'm ready to go.
Well, let me spin up my theremin here.
And, yes. there you go. Yeah, we do need. I should have got a fog machine. I mean, we're not on video, but you know, we should have got a fog machine in.
Should
here.
There be some rapping under the table? Maybe.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
In the theater of the mind. Ready?
Yeah. Oh my God! What is that?
It's the ghosts of podcasts past. All the bad podcast episodes you've ever made.
We'll come back. You'll have to relive them. That's a good little weird fiction horror story.
You thought you had pressed record.
Your biggest guess ever. You thought you pressed record.
Right.
Yeah.
Joe we're talking Rogan, about... is that you? knock five times. All right, go on.
So yeah, so today we're going to talk about Pamela Coleman Smith. And Kevin, as we usually do, I'm going to ask the question. Kevin, what do you know about Pamela Coleman Smith?
Almost nothing. I know what you have told me,
okay,
which is that she is somehow related to the tarot, and you shared on the Art of Dark Pod Twitter account an image of her earlier today, looking rather exotic, I suppose, is a word.
Yeah, we'll get to that too.
Relaxed, looking chill.
Yeah. Man.
That is all I know. And then her name, rather a waspy sounding name that I don't know. Yeah.
Interestingly, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So Pamela Coleman Smith, for people who are even somewhat tarot interested, will at least be familiar with her art. She is the illustrator of what was used to be called the Rider-Waite tarot deck, and now is typically called should be called the Rider-Waite Smith deck. So she illustrated all of those cards, and what's important about that is it's become there are many, many, many tarot decks. Aleister Crowley famously was responsible for a tarot deck, and there are older tarot decks. This has become probably the most popular. This is the Coca-Cola of tarot decks, and I do not mean that derogatorily. It's influenced many that have come behind it. Many, you know, kitty cat tarot deck is sort of based on it, right? From that to everything else. So it's been hugely influential in the tarot world. Though, of course, there's value to many many different styles, but
right. So for people who are following along and maybe don't know the tarot, this is the deck you think of when you think of the tarot.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. If you've got a reading somewhere, this is probably it. If your friend has a deck, they probably have this deck. Most likely, it is by far and away. you know, I haven't looked at the tarot bestseller list recently, but she's the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon of the tarot bestseller list, right?
Oh, I really Michael got Jackson vinyl.
Thriller.
Yeah,
something like that. So I didn't know a ton about her either until digging into this. I just kind of knew that I wanted to do it. And so she's fascinating human being. One thing I think maybe this is a first on Art of Darkness. The darkness here, we've had drug addicts and depressives. We've had people who
are sex addicts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Workaholics, mm-hmm. all of these kinds of things. I think this might be our first episode where the darkness is primarily the dark arts. Okay. So, so we'll kind of see where this goes. So, just scrolling up to my notes here. So Pamela Coleman Smith, she's born in 1878. Dies in, I'm just going to give it away, she dies in September of 1951, right? So she lives to a pretty decent age. She's, as we said, she's the most well-known as the artist behind the Rider-Waite-Smith tarot deck. But she was involved in many, 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 many different artistic projects of all sorts. And so we're going to kind of get into that. So first, we want to place ourselves a little bit in time because the time of her life is very important. So 1878, this is just 4 years before Virginia Woolf, she's born. So it kind of places her a little bit in that time. And she dies not that long after World War II. So this is kind of the time frame that we're dealing with.
That's quite a time period to live through. I mean, yes. I think about people who were born, let's say, in the 50s and who now are beginning to pass away. Mm-hmm. A heck of a change from the 50s to,
oh my gosh,
yeah. To now with the internet and everything. And yet for this group of people, you're talking about radio, you're talking yeah. about film, mm-hmm. You're talking about living to see television take
right.
over,
right.
living through World War I through World War II. What a span of time.
Yeah. And yeah, it's mm-hmm. interesting to, that's a good point. It's interesting to think about Pamela Coleman Smith in her later days, flipping on the telly. It's like, it's, and she probably did at some point. Right. So, yeah. So in another thing that's going to be important in her life is, I'm going to mispronounce this, but it's a term that I've come to love, fin de siècle period, right? The mm-hmm. end of the century period.
Right.
There's this, as before really the modernist movement, we're still dealing with the afterglow of romanticism a little bit. And there's this period of intensive spiritual interest. People are looking outside of traditional religions and they're finding spiritualism with a capital S. And that was big in America, but also big in Europe. They're finding Theosophy with Madame Blavatsky, who died in 1891, but her sort of influence lived on. Gurdjieff was born in 1866, right? So this is a thing. Even when these schools aren't necessarily directly related to each other, there's something going on, right? With these various like alternative.
It's a very woo-woo time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You had the American Civil War, mm-hmm. after which warfare changed, right? Mm-hmm. And getting out of the Civil War, you got into machine guns and
yeah.
things were really developing. And yeah. The people who were preparing to fight World War I were looking back to the American Civil War. What are we gonna see? Death was very mm-hmm. near and immediate. Mm-hmm. The world was more agrarian. Than today, much mm-hmm. more common to live in the country than to live in a city, though of course yeah. people did live in cities, but death yeah. was nearer. And yet, if I may, you mm-hmm. had the dawning of modernity, and in yes. Europe you had trains and the world was opening up and women were becoming mm-hmm. were achieving suffrage and all the rest. So you right. have these colliding realities all happening at once.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that flux is amazing. And you've got to think that these spiritualist movements were a reaction to that in some degree. The Industrial Revolution, I always think of too, like at this time, I mean, we're still living in the Industrial Revolution from a 3,000 or 30,000 foot view. We're still living in the Industrial Revolution, but this time it was like filthy, right? It was the Dickens era. It's soot and it's, you know, there's no regulation.
London fog was yeah. just the exhaust from all of the factories and all the rest of whatnot, the burning coal.
Yeah, so there's got to be a quasi-apocalyptic sort of sense to it if you're in a major city.
Sure, and
they
were right, of course, because she was born in the 1880s.
1878.
So by the time she was a young adult, she was in her 30s, I suppose. What would that put? Yeah, World War One kicks World off. War that I, was an 30s. Apocalypse. Absolutely. Anybody for the West, it was an apocalypse.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, so this is kind of her time frame. Now she's born, and get some basics out here. She's born in London, Pimlico, which doesn't mean much to me, but might mean something to people who have London ties. Her father, now she's got this really interesting family lineage, right? Her father was Charles Edward Smith, who was the son of Cyrus P. Smith, who was the first mayor of Brooklyn. Okay, so she's in this interesting, right? Her mother was named Corinne Coleman, who is known as among the greatest drawing room actresses of the borough, which I don't even really, apparently you'd have in your drawing room, you would have little plays and storytelling events, right?
Pimlico is right off Westminster and Belgravia. And just south of Buckingham Palace.
Oh, okay.
So it's very central, very posh, right on the river.
Okay, cool. So that's where she was born.
Drawing room actor.
Yes, but her parents were Americans, right?
Ah. And
they were over there for business or something like this. Her parents are American. Her uncle was Samuel Coleman, who... it was a pretty famous painter. He actually has a painting that's in the Smithsonian now, which is actually kind of a gorgeous painting called Storm King on the Hudson. But anyway, there's some talent in the DNA.
Storm King State Park is a
in
park
New York.
In New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Junior
South
Barnes
of,
born around there actually.
Yeah. Of, the army. What is it? West Point.
Yeah,
right around that area. Yeah. Yeah,
so they're steeped in America, right? Her grandfather's first mayor of Brooklyn. Her uncle's sort of a semi-famous, you know, maybe not the most famous, but a pretty famous American painter. And then there was and her grandfather on her mother's side was also named Samuel Coleman, was a really well-known bookseller and publisher. He is credited with publishing the first illustrated volume of American verse. So
she was born into a family of blue checks.
She was, yes.
She's for sure. All of her links on Wikipedia are blue. Her parents are blue links on Wikipedia.
Yes, and also her grandmother on her mother's side was a well-known well-known author of children's books for the time.
Wow, a talented family.
Yeah, for sure. For
she
sure.
must have been a terrible disappointment to them.
Yeah, right. Well, and yeah, well, maybe.
I don't know. Love that. You tell me. That.
Her parents were, so there was money, but not a ton of money, right? We're not talking the 0.1%, but maybe we're talking the 5% or the 10% or something like that. They're not destitute by any means, and they're not Jeff Bezos, but someplace in between. So, which I guess we all are. her parents were active. Here's another little thing in the mix that I think is relevant. Her parents were active Swedenborgians. I'm probably not saying that right.
Yes. Okay. Interesting.
I don't know a ton about this. It's sort of a offshoot of Protestantism in some way.
Swedenborg was a mystic, very hardcore mystic. He would be a good episode to do sometime.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe we do have to get there. So she starts out in that environment, and they're active. They host events at their home and things like this, right?
Swedenborg was the type of fellow who, if I'm not mistaken, really claimed to have had prophetic visions that he wrote down. He went and he saw God.
Right. I did come across that. What I was looking for was something that was a differentiating sort of doctrine, and it didn't really, there wasn't much in there that would have split it off of Lutheranism or something. And I'm sure people would disagree about that, but anyway, it's kind of there are she's born into this sort of alternative religion environment. Now, at 10 years old, this is where things get weird, not weird, but things get a little murky biographically, because she isn't written about the way that maybe some of the other people we've done so far have been written about. There's really one biography that came out that I'm dealing with, which is called Pamela Coleman Smith, The Untold Story, which is great and has a lot of her art in it, which was really cool to go through. And then there's a more recent biography that came out, and just came out this year, actually, and I might actually try to get the woman who wrote one of the woman who wrote that book on the podcast, because I had some Twitter interactions with her.
Great. Seems yeah.
Interesting. So
come on.
Yeah. So now at 10 years old, her father takes a job with the Jamaican Railroad. This is like the third or fourth person on the show that's had like a parent or somebody working for a railroad in a foreign country. Apparently this was this must have been a common thing back
then.
Well,
I did mention the railroads earlier, and they were a big deal because of course this is before the automobile.
Yes.
And this is how people got around. Yeah. This is how goods got around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of history could be mined out of looking at where the trains were going.
For sure, for sure. So she spent a lot of time in her youth, starting at age 10 in Jamaica. Now here's where things get a little interesting. So there are people now who claim Pamela Coleman Smith is a woman of color in some fashion. Now, her parents, from everything that I can tell, her parents are basically what we would call white people, as far as I can tell. And then there were people who claim that she must have been Jamaican, because Jamaica actually features pretty big in her work later. But she never went to Jamaica until she was 10 years old. So somewhere, and this is the thing, it's not just off of looking at one photo. To me, looking at a photo, she might be by some means biracial or something, if I were to just glance at her photo.
Yeah, interesting.
But she would, in her life, she would be called these things. So when she was alternatively called by different people, she was called Japanese, she was called Chinese, she was called Black. W.B. Yeats's father referred to her as some sort of primitive American. I don't know what that means.
Oh, no.
So I don't know where this comes from, what, you know, her lineage, what it is, who, you know, the mailman, you know, did they have a black milkman? I'd have no idea, right?
Yeah.
But there's something in there. And people picked up on this, not only because of how she looked, but because of her personality and her style of interacting with the world.
Hmm.
Okay, so... Oh, and then one other thing is, we're kind of like encapsulating her identity. It's most likely that she was a lesbian. She had no romantic male relationships. She had one of these situations where she had a woman who was her housekeeper or her roommate or something like that, particularly a woman named Nora Lake, who she would live with for about 20 years. So just putting that out there, I don't really, these distinctions aren't that important to me. However, I do think it has something... I think as we see going through her life, how self-possessed she was, how confident she was, how much swagger she had, that the fact that she may have been a woman of color at the time, and she was a lesbian most likely, that there's something audacious just about how she rolled. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of her right now, and clearly she had a bohemian style and a sense of herself.
So she's in Jamaica starting at the age of 10. She's bouncing back and forth between the United States, and there might have been a couple trips to England. I am not going to be able to keep track of this, because for a woman living in the steamship age, she was all over the place.
Okay, they must have had some money then.
It eventually kind of runs out, but there was definitely money. So in 1896, so she's what? She's 18 years old. She starts getting really interested in the theater. She's in Jamaica at this time. Her mother dies when she's 15, and her father and her are very close. When her mother dies, she kind of takes over running the household. She starts getting obsessed with the theater. She's reading everything she can about the theater, but she's in Jamaica. So it's all, you know, she's getting magazines that tell you what happened 6 months ago in the theater. And there's no formal theater in Jamaica. So what Pamela Coleman Smith does, because she's so self-possessed and she's so creative, she starts doing what is called miniature theater. She has all these little miniature figures that she paints, she creates and paints, up to 300 of them. She creates little stage designs. She writes a story, and she will put on a little play. And now, when you're 16 or 18 years old, that sounds like a, you know, a charming kind of cool thing to do. But when she gets to New York in 1896, her dad sends her to Pratt. She puts on a show of this, and she makes $95 in three shows, which is $3,000 at the time. She's like 18 years old, right? People loved this thing. She'd written this like convoluted kind of crazy play about fictionalized version of the life of the governor of Jamaica or something like that. Just kind of audacious and kind of awesome. She's at Pratt, she's painting, she gets a little bit of success, not anything broad very early, but, you know, write-ups in little magazines and winning a competition here and there and that kind of thing. So right out the gate, she's already in this sort of multimedia realm. She's making these figures, she's writing a story, she's putting on the play and doing all the voices. She's painting, you know, she's painting pictures good enough to be very competitive at a very good art school for the time, right? So, now,
I love this image of her playing with these little figurines, right? What yeah. popped into my mind is it's maybe a more feminine version of kind of like Warhammer. I mean, that really is all that these boys are doing in their parents' basements. Yeah. It's like a kind of weird theater, right?
Theater.
And they're rolling the dice and bizarre.
For sure.
What a world.
She's doing this kind of thing, and she's getting better and better at her art. And so, I got a little thing I want to read. This is very early on. I think she was, I guess this would have been around when she was 20 or so. She gets a little write-up in this magazine called Brush and Pencil. This was actually in 1900, so she was 22. And we're going to get to some other stuff that was going on in this period for her, but I like this. So this was in Brush and Pencil, a magazine at the time. Even in this day of unusual movements in art, it is not an ordinary thing to find one so absolutely untrammeled by tradition of the schools, so unhampered by the whisperings of convention and art, so undeterred by any dictates of precedent from venturing further afield, and one so masterfully conquering color and tactfully forcing an allegiance of it to purpose which has come whole-souled as Pamela Coleman Smith, whose work stands unique in America and certainly as unique everywhere. Now, I would have killed to get a write-up like that when I was 22
years old. Oh my God, it's right? Gonna go right to your head.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Yeah. You know, not only, like, it's one thing that somebody's like, oh, you're super talented. Another thing to be like, you are unique in the country. Like, what? So that's where she's at. Now, I wanna talk a little bit of what her art is actually like, because we don't have any visuals here. If you've seen the tarot cards, the Rider-Waite-Smith tarot deck, that's kind of the style typical of what she was doing. She was very influenced by the arts and crafts movement, which I don't know if you know much about the arts and crafts
movement. I do. The house that we live in is an arts and crafts house. And this is my stepfather is obsessed with this stuff. There's a very particular way you're supposed to have the house decorated. We're not cleaving to it here,
right.
But it's a very particular style, a very particular thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, so for her, part of it was the DIY aspect, which I think the arts and crafts ended up being maybe a little bit of a pushback on the Industrial Revolution, right? It's and for her, it meant an interest in a little bit of like revisionist medievalism too, right? Like being interested in that aesthetic. So she's influenced by that. She's influenced clearly just by looking at what she does. She's influenced by William Blake. There's also a little bit of a Japanese line to her work. Those sort of famous, like, the Tidal Wave by, I can't remember.
Yeah, sure. I know what you're talking about.
Those kinds of that sort of genre is definitely influential on her. So we're not talking about like Caravaggio or Rembrandt, these deeply, deeply rendered oil paintings that take forever. It's a little bit lower resolution than that, a little bit more fanciful. You know, there's fairies in her early stuff and that sort of thing. So that's kind of just her realm. So I wanted to kind of paint that picture because she is, let me just talk about this period for her. There is a 3-year period right around 1900 where her level of productivity to me is kind of astonishing. Okay. So, in 3 year period, she has she makes an alphabet, a Shakespeare alphabet for children. So each page is A is for whatever, and she has an illustration. She does multiple illustrations for Collier's Weekly. She has a cover for Bookbuyer magazine, and she has a whole Christmas card deal with this art dealer, William Macbeth. She does a calendar of Shakespeare's heroines. She does an illustrated book of Jamaican folklore, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And she writes that as well. She illustrates it and writes it. She does two other illustrated booklets, Golden Vanity, which I think is maybe her best illustrations, and something of the Green Bed or something. She does illustrations for a play called Trelawney of the Wells. She does illustrations for this guy, Seamus McManus's collection of Irish folktales, and a couple of other things. So this is all in this like 3 year period where she's basically, she didn't finish at Pratt, but she's like college aged at this point. She's like 22, 23, 24, right in there.
Right in there, but they grew up faster back then, too.
That's true.
You're they a grown have. Person. You're yes. in New York. You're yes. on your yeah, you're on your own.
Yeah. So her big thing, actually, I was saying 22, 23, 24. It's actually a little bit earlier than this, because the one big item in there that stands out to me just looking at all of this work is this thing she did called Anansi Stories. Anansi Stories was an illustrated book of Jamaican folklore. She was super into folklore, which, oh, you got something?
Anansi, like the spider?
Yes.
Okay, Anansi,
yeah, yeah, spider. So she spelled it, spelled it A-N-N-A-N-C-Y, but the typical spelling is A-N-A-N-S-I.
Yeah, uh-huh, okay.
So he's this Jamaican folklore character who's a spider, but can also sometimes transform into a human being. So this comes out in 1896, and this is, I think, the reviews for it were amazing, first of all. And the next, I think this is where we start to get, this is the first product she puts out where you really start to get an idea of like how she looks at the world. So I'm going to read a little, thing from this Stuart Kaplan. There's actually like four people who wrote this book. I think this part is by Mary Kay Greer. quote, her depictions are the first known published drawings of Anansi, a traditional African folk tale character who is also one of the most important characters in Caribbean folklore. The trickster figure can assume the form of both a man and a spider. Pamela calls this figure Anansi and highlights his wily tricks, a pronounced sense of humor, and a deliberate refusal to follow established rules. Unlike other contemporaneous accounts, Pamela's Anansi is not as aggressive and is often bested by other animals. This can be seen in the first story of the collection. I have another thing. Oh, so, and here are some responses to it. The New York Herald wrote about it. The Pittsburgh Daily Post wrote about it. And in general, you can summarize the reception of it like this. An effusive article about Pamela in the collection, which was syndicated in several newspapers across the country, noted with the most astonishing invention, imagination, and humor, she has pictured a series of strange, alluring little people who cannot fail to win the childish heart and at the same time delight appreciative grown folks. Right? So this is just a sort of a beloved object for people. And
Pixar of the day.
Yeah, yeah, for real. And so one thing that was notable about it was she wrote it in Jamaican Pidgin.
Ah, wow.
So she and the publishers tried to talk her out of it, and she was like, no, this is how these stories are told.
Has artistic integrity. Incredible.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, amazing.
Right. So it's pretty cool. And she's 1896. I mean, she's not even 20 years old yet. She's done this, right?
Wow.
So, yeah. So impresses me right off the bat. Like, even if you're not into Jamaican folklore, and that's fine. But just the you know what I mean?
Sure.
The audacity of it, the singular sort of invention, the ability to work across multiple disciplines and all of that. So folklore is kind of a big deal to her. She works on this Seamus McManus Tales of Irish Folklore. I'm interested. I've always been interested in the cross-pollination of African diaspora culture and Irish diaspora culture. Just like, you know, times where perhaps these two groups were working in the same fields and all of that. I've just always
There's that moment in Titanic where they're doing a jig and all of it, and mm-hmm. And they mentioned in Gangs of New York too.
Yeah. There's something there.
Yeah.
So she's got, you know, by 1899, they've published this collection of Irish folk tales with her illustrations in it. She's 22 years old. This is when she starts to, her father dies around this time. Now, her father was, her and her were super close. Whenever she was traveling as a young lady, she was with her dad, and her dad was able to like set up these meetings with her. And I don't know if he set them up, I guess. It's not clear, but he definitely was there and was interested in making them productive. Like he was trying to set up Pamela Coleman's.
It was like acting like an agent or a manager.
A little bit. Yeah. He helped her get, apparently it's as far as I can tell, he helped her get this deal with the Irish folk story. He helped her meet W.B. Yeats's father. She would later meet W.B. Yeats. There were some other folks that kind of helped her get publishing deals and all of that kind of thing. After Anansi, she starts getting, you know, a whole bunch of attention. She starts to get a bunch of different opportunities. Her father dies in 1899, so she moves to London more or less permanently. She's going to be in England basically the rest of her life, kind of going back and forth. She gets a gig doing stage design.
All right.
Yeah. So,
one of us,
she was into the theater for sure. Now she wasn't an actress. She didn't write many more plays beyond her, the miniature theater thing. But she was always sort of around the theater, and we'll get into that in a second. But what's becoming obvious in her work is she's very interested, even with the Nancy stories and beyond that, she was very interested in doing like small runs of like hand printed, hand colored stuff. Like it seemed like she would prefer to put out 500 expensive versions of something that she had touched every single one of them rather than like mass production. She did the mass production for money. Like she would do prints, and you know, she had integrity, but she also like wasn't shy about trying to make a buck either. You know, she kind of was able to kind of balance.
Yeah. London things. It's not a cheap town. Right. Yeah. You gotta pay rent.
It's right.
You gotta make rent, man.
Yeah.
And Crowley is around in this time too. So we're sort of in the same.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly his years, but yeah, I am sure that they cross paths, because what we're going to find out here in a second is that she basically met everybody.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So she gets these theater gigs, and she sort of gets pulled into the theater world a little bit. And she meets a man, Henry Irving, who was a prominent actor, but also the owner of the Lyceum Theater, which maybe you've heard of or know.
Probably sure, more than I'm I pretty do. Sure. I'm going to look it up. But yeah, I think I know the one.
Yeah, so this
about.
Was a pretty famous, maybe even the most famous theater in London at the turn of the century. They would put on a lot of Shakespeare, but also a lot of, you know, a lot of other stuff, and then also a lot of original theater.
That's right in the middle of everything.
Okay. So she becomes really good friends with Henry Irving. Through him becomes really good friends with Ellen Terry, who Ellen Terry is apparently at this time is like the most famous actress in Europe. And even though she's 30 years older than Pamela, they become fast friends. Ellen Terry gives Pamela her nickname, which she would sign on letters for years, of Pixie. So Pamela Coleman Smith was the original manic pixie dream girl, right?
I love it. She's amazing. This is amazing. Now this is the Art of Dark podcast, so there has to be some darkness here soon. But this is great. I'm a fan now.
She's killing
already.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's killing it.
Yeah, so, she's killing the game.
Yeah. Yeah, so she's doing illustrations for like promotional material, posters, brochures, and that sort of thing for the Lyceum Theater. Also, like Christmas time comes around, she's like busy as a beaver or a bee. I don't know what is it. Bee?
Yeah, busy as a beaver.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So she's got to get out these Christmas cards that she's got to deal for. She's got to.
She's
get
a prints. Working
she's
artist.
Yeah.
She's over here. Yeah. Grinding.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a job, and she's. I don't know if she's getting rich off of it. But she's making money off of it. Her cousin is a guy named William Gillette, and William Gillette is known as probably his claim to fame. Though I read that he retired in a castle in Connecticut.
He's the father of the razor blade.
I thought so. That's what I thought too. I was like, is this what we're going to be dealing with? However, he is his claim to fame. He was the first person to portray Sherlock Holmes on stage.
Ah.
Okay, so now go back in your memory. Forget Benedict Cumberbatch. Forget Robert Downey Jr. Give me, what does Sherlock Holmes look like? Like, what's his style?
Tall.
Okay.
Thin.
Okay.
Bowler hat. No.
Deer stalker hat.
Oh, right. Of course. Right. Yeah. No. Right. Right. The bowling hat would be, or the bowler hat would be the, would be Watson.
Yeah.
The pipe.
The pipe.
Yeah.
So apparently, the first image that ever showed up of Sherlock Holmes in wearing that was a promotion for William Gillette starring as Sherlock Holmes.
Mm. And then that got tagged on.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And Pamela Coleman-Smith illustrated that.
Okay.
It's not clear if Pamela Coleman-Smith came up with this getup. It's not apparently clearly defined in the early Arthur Conan Doyle. But so it's very possible that she basically came up with what Sherlock Holmes looks like, which is a
very
sort of
cool.
Random kind
that
of thing,
is a
right?
Fun, right? But that this is the Sherlock Holmes fandom. Mm-hmm. That is the kind of factoid they would love. I guarantee it.
That's right. That's right. So it's not clear. You know, she may have made up some of it. Maybe William Gillette made up some of it. Maybe he had a pipe sitting around and he thought it would be cool to smoke, whatever. But that's just kind of an interesting thing. Another person she meets at this time is Bram Stoker.
Oh, wow.
And she would become lifelong friends with Bram Stoker. Bram Stoker at this time, he had already written Dracula, but it hadn't sort of risen to prominence quite yet. And
he didn't say it properly. It hadn't risen to prominence. I couldn't help myself. It just seemed like that's quite cool. That's a heavy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So she's 22, 24 years old. Her best friends apparently are one of the most famous actresses on the continent. And a man who has already written the work that will make him a all-time
name.
Author. Yeah. Everybody, my parents know who Bram Stoker is. So it's just interesting. She managed to just kind of get herself in that place. And there was a little bit of, I think there was a little bit of silver spoon in the mouth, at least culturally speaking. But she also had the talent and the industry to back it up. So
I really wonder what her accent sounded like. Do we have audio of her somewhere?
No, audio or video of her that I could find. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
grew up in London, right? In a very posh part of London, then ends up in Jamaica, then in New York, and then back in London. I just wonder what she sounded like.
Yeah. Yeah. And spending those years, 10 to 15 in Jamaica, and then also knowing the pigeon well enough to write a book in it, like some of that has to rub off a little bit, right?
Sure.
So yeah, it would be interesting to know kind of what her style was, her accent. So we've kind of laid it out. Here's one thing I'm going to talk about the next sort of important phase of her life as she's getting more solid in the London art scene. I want to talk about her work ethic as described by her good friend Ellen Terry. So this is in describing the busy part of the season. Ellen Terry is impressed by Pamela's work ethic and states that, quote, she's extraordinarily industrious and everlastingly making and selling as fast as she makes. All right. So this is a woman who just can go home and, with her imagination, with a few painting supplies, she can just churn out a living. Right. I'm in awe of that to a certain extent. So she's industrious. She's well liked. It's clear that she's really good at making friends. She starts having a weekly salon in her Chelsea studio that becomes sort of a fixture. You could almost think of it as like, it's not quite the Bloomsbury group, or what was Virginia Woolf? She was in a sort of a
Bloomsbury,
right? Mm-hmm. It's not quite. That's probably the A class of this in the intellectual and artistic scene, and this is maybe like the second tier of that same kind of thing.
Sure,
she has these weekly salons. Oftentimes, the weekly salons were a big part of them. Would be she would, turn the lights out or whatever, and light a few candles, and she would sit on the floor and she would start telling everybody stories. She was apparently an absolutely captivating storyteller. So much so that one of her gigs, she would literally hire herself out to tell stories at parties. So you would, you know, you would write up Pamela Coleman Smith. Can you come to our party and we'll sit around and we'll drink and we'll
hear the folk tale from Jamaica. Yeah. Man, we got to bring this back. Yeah, right? We got to get cool? back to this. I mean, that is way too fun. These phones cool. and these screens, yeah. you know, they have their place, but man,
yeah,
you'd
yeah.
just be able to plink out a tune on the piano and
right.
everybody'd
right,
have right. a few drinks and you'd sing a tune and Pamela would show up and
yeah. And she shows up and she's mysterious. She's kind of ambiguous and she has maybe a slightly weird accent that you can't quite place. And she's right. wearing beads and strange colors. And, you know, she jingles a little bit when she walks.
Tell you about the trickster spider right. god right. creature. Yeah. Right. So cool. You know, and this gets lost because we're so cynical now, but astrology has room for this. Like a lot of this mm-hmm. stuff, the tarot, astrology, mm-hmm. these are just systems of storytelling.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
I mean, I knew a fellow over here in Minneapolis who I fell out of touch with, met him. This is an aside, but it's worth That's it. Right. Met him on this famous beach over in Minneapolis, west of Minneapolis, called like Hippie Beach or whatever. And it was a crazy nude beach. And all the freaks and the geeks would show up there. And this was an older guy at the time. And I don't even know if he's still with us, but he was an astrologer yeah. with a computer devoted to astrology.
Oh, wow.
He would show up at the party and he would bring your chart and he would do this and that. And yeah. he would just captivate college age students. Sure. And everybody would gather around him and just sit and listen. And it's better than putting Netflix on.
For sure.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, that's the thing. I think that's the thing that can get lost in these. I mean, I'm somewhat of a tarot devotee, but like if you try to get too rational about this stuff, I think you lose a little bit of the magic, but you also just lose like the fun of it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh, if you just, oh, that's a bunch of hooey. Like, well, okay. Even if it is like, right. don't you just want to like have a cool moment?
Yeah, and the same rationalists and materialists who say, oh, that's a bunch of hooey, then they yeah. go to their science conference and they right. all get right. completely wasted and right. Fooling around with each other. They all end yeah. up doing the same thing.
Yeah, and they cite studies with no replication, no history of replication.
right, right. You know, look up replication crisis, yeah, kids. Exactly. We're things are not working out quite the way that we had hoped. Yeah,
yeah, for real. So, and this is a good time to kind of talk about that, because as I was reading this, I realized that, and I'm going to give you the next chapter of why this is true, but I realized that Pamela was sort of the perfect person to do the tarot, right? She's born in this sort of alternative religion that believes that people can have divine visions. She goes to Jamaica and learns the folklore there. She learns the Irish folklore well enough to illustrate this book. She learns Shakespeare, which is a kind of English folklore, right? In a way.
Well, he drew on a lot of folklore for
sure,
his work.
Right. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So she's steeped in folklore and mythology, which all plays on this very, very deep, like, you know, Campbellian Jungian imagery, right? She's fascinated with storytelling. And she's, you know, a top shelf illustrator. So she's sort of building herself up unbeknownst to her to be the person to do this, I think.
Right.
And the next stage is she gets really involved in, the Irish Literary Society. She's not Irish, but she gets very involved in it. And she gets involved in a group called the Maskers. And I didn't know anything about the Maskers. And I kind of wish I'd had some time. I'd have done a deeper dive just out of curiosity. This was a group that, among other things, would get together and they would chant W.B. Yeats's poetry.
Whoa, doggy.
So it's got to be weird, right?
He did win a Nobel Prize. And I use yeah. a Yeats at the beginning of one of my plays as a poem. But I'd be lying if I said I was a hardcore Yeats person.
I have to admit I am not. You know, I know a little bit about him, you know, being an English major and an Irish guy, I know a little bit about him. But like, yeah, I never really dug that deep into him.
Did Yeats support the chanting maskers who rocked out to his stuff? I mean,
that's a good question. I mean, what you have to think, like, Okay.
You'd almost be embarrassed by it, I think.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Like, you write and I write. If you imagine you found out there was a group of people who got around and like chanted your stuff, like.
I think it depends on the demographics of the people. if I find out it's a bunch of.
When you're 25 and single, it's a bunch of young women.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, let's be real here. Cool. Yeah. It's the Kautzman Society here.
Right. I'll go down and I'll deign to go meet with them.
It's like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You come to the castle. Right. Yeah, no, it's going to end up being a bunch of Reddit neckbeards who think that I'm putting code into my plays.
Right. Oh, man. So, she's involved in both of these groups. She apparently liked W.B. Yeats's folklore work more than his poetry. But there were a bunch of other people, involved in these groups, a guy named Walter Crane, which I didn't know much about, but the poet and Irish nationalist, that was the second thing on his Wikipedia article, George Russell, who is better known as just A.E. These people were theosophists. They were in the Dublin arm of the theosophy movement, which for people who don't know, this was a Madame Blavatsky spiritual with not a capital S, because spiritualism is like we're going to go have seances. This was a sort of a new religion that was sort of popping up. Madame Blavatsky might be a cool episode,
Oh, yeah, that'd be a great
down
one.
The line. She's a pretty interesting lady. And, people claim she was a fraud. And then, she also had some pretty profound things to say. So Pamela's in this whole sort of scene. She's clearly interested in it. And they like her and she likes them. And in 1901, she joined something called the Isis Urania Temple of the Order of the Golden Dawn.
Ah, so she joins the Golden Dawn.
Joins the Golden Dawn.
Oh. That's
right. Yeah. The Golden Dawn. Yeah. So this is where you get into why I said in the beginning, the dark in this episode is literally the dark arts.
Crowley was a member of the Golden Dawn, and then there was a famous falling out.
Yes. So there were a bunch of famous people, creatives and others.
I think he may have lampooned Coleman Smith Crowley in the Moonchild book. I think he may have written her up as because he wrote this. He was a very cruel man. He was very mean.
Yes.
And if you belonged to a set that he had a falling out with, it wasn't enough just to forgive and forget. He would write you into a novel as a character and mock you horribly. Of course, he was the real demon.
That could be. I didn't come across that, but that could totally be the case. He was it was at least a member of the same order of the Golden Dawn sect for a while as Pamela Coleman Smith. So certainly they crossed paths. Other members, we could literally just do an episode on everybody that was in the Order of the Golden Dawn. Arthur Conan Doyle, Bram Stoker, of course, W.B. Yeats, Sax Rohmer, who I didn't know of, but it was the guy who created the Fu Manchu character. And notably for the story of Pamela Coleman Smith, a man named Arthur Edward Waite, who is the Waite in the Rider-Waite tarot deck.
Right.
Okay. So I'm going to get into the tarot deck, the tarot thing, but there's one sort of sidetrack that I want to take. So we've mentioned before,
this thing about the Golden Dawn, right? This is a system, it's a ceremonial magical order, drawing on, I presume, what we would call the Western esoteric tradition and Kabbalah. Correct.
Yeah, Kabbalah, the hermetic texts that were extant at the time.
Yeah,
there was a split eventually between the Yeats crowd, who was more interested in the sort of occult magical practices, the Waite crowd, who was a little bit more of a Christian spin on things. These groups would just like fragment basically upon
a lot of big personalities attracted to this.
Yes.
It's extremely high nerddom.
It is. In a certain sense, it is. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And they're playing dress up in various basements.
Esoteric texts.
Yeah. And like, a lot of posturing.
And, yeah. And the thing is, I totally agree with that. And then at the same time, I don't like to totally dismiss it because, like, I've read a bunch of the Hermetic texts.
Yeah.
And there are some interesting and enlightening things in there, right? So, like, you understand why they gravitated to it, but there's some of the personalities that are a little weird, right? It's just like anything. There's like status. There's like, you know, puffing up the chests. And I read all of, you know, this guy read more ancient books than this guy. So now he's the big deal. And like, there's a lot of weirdness like that for sure.
I love that stuff though. I say nerds with respect. I think it's fun. I really actually believe we need to bring back adults playing dress up.
Yeah.
We used to have it. Fun. Even if it was just bowling league and you would have your shirts together as a team, we need to bring it back.
There's something to that for sure, right? Yeah. And I like even just the aesthetics of the occult stuff. You know, the dark and candles and, you know, weird symbols and sigils and I kind of like all that stuff. They can get real dorky real quick, but I don't know.
There's always an element of maybe there is something behind that door that's worth looking into. What's behind that?
Right. Yeah. For sure. So Pamela was clearly interested in this world. She didn't get, and the other thing about these groups, they're always so hierarchical. Like she didn't get past like whatever, the second order of zealotry or whatever, you know.
Was she part of like a woman's order inside the Golden
Dawn? No, so the Golden Dawn Golden Dawn was really co-ed. They didn't, that was one thing about them is they didn't make any decisions.
Well, that's admirable.
I think so. But it's not clear like what they did. I mean, I'm sure you could do some readings and find out like what did they do at their meetings and all that. I assume that most anything, like it starts out with a purpose and then it eventually just devolves into getting drunk and trying to get laid. But
and then Crowley made that his whole thing.
Right. He just decided at some point, I was like, well, let's just get to the chase here. We'll read a line of poetry and then we'll get it on. So I want to get to a couple other things. So 1901, she joins the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. She meets Arthur E. Waite. Tara's a couple of years down the road, but there's some stuff that's starting to go on in between. One is she's really interested in doing stuff DIY, small press, hand colored, whatever. She puts out a thing called a broadsheet at first, and then a green sheaf. And it's kind of a cool idea. It's like the original zine. So like what you would get is you would get a subscription and then once a month or whatever, you would get a one page object that would be like one, two or three illustrations that she had done and hand colored. And then there would be like little bits of poems and stories on there. She wrote a lot of them, but like other people will contribute to them as well.
Like a little subscription service.
Yeah. And it's kind of cool. I mean,
join my Substack.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Patreon.com/artofdarkpod.
There you go. There you go. Subscribe folks. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So she was doing that and trying to make money. She was, W.B. Yeats would start to contribute to it at times. I think broadsheet more than the green sheaf. And then she was involved with W.B. Yeats's brother, Jack Yeats, in the Green Sheaf. But they would have all kinds of stuff, various, you know, all these people who came to her salon at her house and various other members of the Golden Dawn would contribute to these things. She also would eventually turn into she would turn the Green Sheaf into an actual publishing house at some point. So it didn't last for very long, but she put out a bunch of novels and books of poetry and things like that. Very interested in making a thing, you know. Just writing the story wasn't quite enough for her.
Make the object. Yeah. I want to embody it in the world. Yeah,
which I think is kind of cool. Now, there's another thing she starts doing around this time, in this Golden Dawn time. And it, Kevin, do you know what synesthesia is?
I do.
Okay, what is synesthesia?
Well, that sentence makes me think of the color orange for some reason. No, synesthesia is a condition where the senses become mixed. So if you hear a certain tone, you might correspond with a color. You see the color in your mind's eye from the sound. And it's a recognized, almost like a medical condition.
Right. Yeah, it's like a cross-wiring of the senses. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Now, apparently... they didn't have this term when Pamela Coleman Smith was alive, but apparently she had a degree of synesthesia. Now, her thing, we don't get much of her. There's a little bit of her talking about it, but apparently how it worked for her was when she heard a piece of music, she would get like a fully formed image of the music in her head, and she would paint, she started to paint these. They're some of her best work is these synesthesia drawings, these paintings to music.
I have to say, given her background and how talented she is, and how, this doesn't surprise me somehow. Yeah. Clearly, she was wired a little differently.
Yeah, she's sort of touched. Yeah, her brain doesn't quite work the way that everybody else is, in a great way, right?
Sure, yeah,
we're all clearly sort of better off for it. This is another thing you talk about. I was talking about all the people that she's met. This book just mentions in passing that she was friends with Claude Debussy. How do you pronounce it?
Debussy.
Yeah. So apparently she was friends with him, which of course.
That's amazing. And of course he did The Rite of Spring, which was based on had folkloric elements and very famously caused a riot in Paris when it premiered.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
great.
Yeah, so I'm going to read just a little bit about the synesthesia thing. So Pamela's ability to visualize music she heard is one of the most important keys to her artistic ability. Is evidence that she had synesthesia. Okay, we already talked about that. We actually kind of already killed that. I want to find the spot where, here's where Debussy talks about her. He basically believed that her compositions made his dreams visible. So like he saw the paintings and was like, yes, that's what I was trying to do, which that's the biggest, right? Like if you happen to be a synesthetic music painter, that's what you want. You want some other musical genius to come.
Pretty high praise. Yeah. Wild.
That's exactly what I was trying to do.
Wow. She did know everybody. She was really rocking and rolling.
She was, right. Okay. So here is a description of, she would start doing these performances live. So she would do a painting live with like a quartet or something, right? Or a person playing the piano at the very least. So it was another thing, you know, she's selling herself out to play music at, to tell stories at parties. She's selling Christmas card prints and she's doing these mystical synesthetic music painting performances, right? Just like in 1905, like that had been the coolest thing happening.
Basically. Crowley would do this too, not to continue to keep coming back to Crowley, but I know too much about him for various reasons. I just think he's fascinating. But he did something similar around this period, or maybe a little later, might have been between the wars, but where he would host these trippy freak out parties with light shows and all the rest and drugs. About this is something that you would think about like San Francisco in the mid 60s or the late 60s. Right. They were already doing it in London.
They were partying. They were reaching heights, and it makes you wonder, like the Golden Dawn, were they imbibing something, you know?
Right What was this? Was this really an early, like a proto rave culture? Yeah. And they just trapped it all in all of this goofery.
Music, right. The music sounded a little different. But if you take a snapshot of Burning Man, there's like it doesn't look exactly the same, but it looks like people are doing the same thing to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to that. So I'm going to read this little thing about from French critic G. Jean Aubry, who apparently was a friend of Joseph Conrad. So she probably met Joseph Conrad too. He's talking about Pamela's, describing watching Pamela Coleman Smith do one of these synesthetic pieces. She comprehends music visually, whether a symphonic piece or a piano composition. For her, the musical impression is immediately transformed into a graphic image. I've seen her curled up in a corner at a concert with her sketchbook on her knees, a sepia brush in her hand, listening to the work, following the rhythm and smiling, working without haste, as if she had the time to put down her impressions in a few seconds, the time of 20 measures. The scarred page, caressed, scratched, shows varied sketches, some like one of the charming series of Schumann's Carnival, others in the style of Song of the Land by Severet, The Valley of Clocks by Ravel, the images or prints of Debussy, or the reminiscent of Dvorak's symphony from the New World, or Beethoven's symphonies and works by Bach, Scarlatti, Purcell, or Byrd. Right. So she was clearly being sort of taken away by something in these experiences.
Very sensitive gal.
Yeah. So, and this is from a 1908 article, and this is Pamela talking about it herself. And then we're going to get to the tarot stuff. There stretched far away are plains and mountains and the billowy sea. And as the music forms a net of sound, the people who dwell there enter the scene, tall, slow-moving, stately queens with jeweled crowns and garments gay or sad, who walk on mountaintops or stand beside the shore, watching the water people. These water folks are passionless and sway or fall with little heed of time. They toss the spray and, bending down, dive headlong through the deep. Right. So that's just her like describing these images sort of entering her head as she listens to this music.
So. Everything is so sensual and draped with feeling and high romance and everything. Yes. It really makes me a little depressed about how banal and corporate and ground down everything is in our environment, and ugly. And can you imagine dropping Pamela Coleman Smith into a strip mall in the American Midwest
and think she'd
telling her to make do?
Right.
Just
right. Oh my gosh. Ugh. Yeah. Right. Just the aesthetic bluntness of everything. Just the
utilitarianism are just gonna get on with it. Right. Yeah, no, this is lush and verdant and every idea sparks another idea. Right. And what a joy to wake up in London in 1901 and know you have a party to go to later and your friends are going to be there and so and so will play the violin and you'll do a drawing in the corner. And,
right. Sounds awesome.
We got to bring it back, people.
No, I don't know how we do this, but yes, I agree. So 1909 rolls around. And one other thing. So this is real quick about her storytelling. I kind of missed this in the order of things, but it's worth telling because it's written by J.M. Barrie, who is the creator of Peter Pan. Okay. So he's talking about her ability to storytell, right? And this is a little bit of a diversion, but I don't want to miss it just because it's another famous person she knows who thought she was amazing. From J.M. Barrie. "I know of no more delightful entertainment for children than yours. So quaint, so simple. And it is the prettiest of pictures, the children sitting agape around you." Right? So he's just like, I don't know. I'm just interested that all these people that she came into contact with who historically we think of as these great talents, and they were, including her friend Ellen Terry, who said about Pamela Coleman Smith's storytelling, "Since hearing your stories, I have told no other." Right? All of these people are just enamored with her. It's just, it's cool.
Yeah, she rolled a 20 on charisma.
She did. Somehow.
Real charisma and a varied talent, theatrical, clearly an eye for design, drawing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
A bit of an autodidact. I mean, I read she went into Pratt when she was 15.
Yes, yes.
Incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah. She's prodigious. Prodigious. For sure.
Absolutely.
So now I want to talk about the tarot stuff. And this might take some time, but sadly, there's not a whole lot after the tarot. So 1909 rolls around. Arthur Edward Waite has decided that he wants to do a new tarot deck and that he knows just the right person for the job. So to give a little background of the tarot deck, and I could nerd out about this forever. So I'm gonna try not to do that. But
on the After Dark episode, which is available to Patreon subscribers, we will interrogate Brad Kelly's obsession with the tarot further.
Okay.
Artofdarkpod.com.
Okay.
Or patreon.com/artofdarkpod.
Yeah, get it. And, I listened back to those for the first time. And because I got on a Patreon. I got to support the show. It's my favorite podcast.
Right? Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and they're good. They're fun.
Yeah. They're extra little episodes. If you can't get enough of this, or if you just want to support the content we're making, get over there and subscribe. I think it starts at what, like $3 a month? You won't even notice it.
Yeah. You got another thing to listen to. And it is good. We do a good job.
Nice. Thank you.
So the tarot card deck for people who don't know is very similar to your traditional poker deck. There are four suits in the tarot. They are swords, cups, pentacles and wands or rods. Sometimes pentacles are called coins. Some people have claimed that the playing card deck came out of the tarot deck. Some people claim it's the other way around. The provable history indicates that it was first probably a card game that was later used for divination. What separates it most strongly organizationally from a poker card deck is the fact that in addition to those suited cards, there are 22 of what are called the major arcana. And these are cards like that you've, even if you know almost nothing about the tarot, you've probably heard. There's a card called the Hanged Man, and there's a card called Death, and the Devil, and the Fool, and the Hermit, right? Everybody's sort of somewhat familiar with these.
It appears in pop culture, if you've never seen a deck in person, and you know what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So these cards, they stretch back to the first description of them. The first description of a playing card deck that could have some resemblances to the tarot card deck is from 1377 by a monk in Switzerland. And then later in 1400 or so, you start getting documentation within the church talking about cards as in terms of gambling. We have no mention of divination whatsoever. By 1480, we've got Franciscan friars talking about the tarot trumps as the rungs of a ladder which lead to the depths of hell, right? So sometime between 1377 and 1480, somebody has started to use these for things other than just playing games. By about 1500, we have the Marseille deck of France, which was basically the equivalent of the Rider-Waite-Smith deck until the Rider-Waite-Smith deck was invented. It was a sort of a standard deck that was used all over the place. And then on top of that, you would have commissioned customized decks for families. The earliest complete deck is something known as the Visconti Sforza deck, which was basically a wealthy family in Europe had commissioned these from an artist, and it includes most of the familiar trumps that you see now. Pretty much everything in the genealogy, pretty much all of the decks sort of come after that. There are things that are provable and that scholarship has determined, and then there are things that are not. So there's a lot of people like Manly P. Hall and Arthur E. Waite who claim that the tarot as currently envisioned in the Rider-Waite deck, Rider-Waite-Smith deck, that this is wisdom that goes all the way back to Egypt. Now, most likely, I mean, you can borrow Egyptian elements and put them at any time you want as you're changing decks over time. Most likely, this was just like a callback to, like, at the time, Egypt was this, like, mysterious place where deep ancient wisdom was held. And there's a little bit of truth to that. It's this crazily sophisticated culture that's almost like, it's so sophisticated for its time, it's almost like an anachronism, right? So you can see how it gets this sort of magical power, right? So Waite, being a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn, he wanted his own deck for divinatory practices. This is basically, the simple way to say it is telling the future, but it's the tarot is way more complicated about that than that. We can talk more about that in the After Dark episode. But he knew he needed somebody to paint these cards because Arthur E. Waite was not a visual artist. He's not even a particularly good writer. I've read some of his writing. So he needed some help, and he knew the perfect person to do it. And I'm going to read you a little bit from him. We'll find out what he thought about Pamela Coleman Smith, why he picked her to paint these cards, not only paint the major trumps, the major arcana, which had been painted for centuries at this point, but she would be one of the first people to paint the minor arcana, that is having a specific illustration for all 78 cards of the entire deck, which sort of hadn't been done yet. And we'll talk about that in a second. So this is from Arthur E. Waite. I'm talking about Pamela. Now, in those days, there was a most imaginative and abnormally psychic artist named Pamela Coleman Smith, who had drifted into the Golden Dawn and loved the ceremonies, as transformed by myself. I don't even know what that means there. Anyway, without pretending or indeed attempting to understand their subsurface consequence, right? She wasn't, to him, she wasn't trying to understand what was going on.
It was a good show. She enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Good for her. That's the way to be.
Yeah, agreed. It seemed to some of us in the circle that there was a draftswoman among us who, under proper guidance, could produce a tarot with an appeal in the world of art and a suggestion of significance behind the symbols, which would put on them another construction than had ever been dreamed by those who, through many generations, had produced and used them for mere divinatory purposes. My province was to see that the designs, especially those of the important Trump Major, kept that in the hiddenness which belonged to certain greater mysteries in the past. He's got a lot of capitalized words in here, by the way, that I'm not, you know what I mean?
Mystery. Yeah, the more woo M. And flim flam that you can throw in.